It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the owners of a social gaming store in Eau Claire. He'll explain what social gaming is and how he's trying to build a community around gaming. First, four United States senators, including Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin, unveiled legislation today that would set new safety regulations for trains hauling crude oil throughout the country. The bill comes in response to the increase of crude oil traveling on the nation's rails. The American Association of Railroads reports that nearly 500,000 rail carloads of crude were on the move in 2014, way up from just over 400,000 in 2013. In addition, several high-profile, fiery derailments have also drawn attention to the issue, but the bill faces an unclear future in Congress. Here to talk more about what's in the legislation is Alan Stankovitz. He's a member of Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, or CARS, and he consulted with Senator Baldwin's office on the new legislation. Alan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with a bit of the why Senator Baldwin and others are introducing this bill. Now, we heard some of the numbers there, but why are we seeing so much crude oil being moved through the nation by train?
Well, why has to do with economics, really. We've got the Bakken region out in North Dakota, which has got a lot of oil that is a fracked oil, so it's a very thin, volatile oil, and it has to go somewhere. There's no refineries in North Dakota. So that oil has to go somewhere, and as far as pipelines, there really aren't any pipelines available to transport this oil. So a lot of it is being transported by rail across the United States, a lot of it going to the East Coast, the Gulf Coast, and also the West Coast to refineries.
Now, when we see images in the media of some of these derailments, the crashes with the fire, there's often these billowing clouds, so that's an issue of volatility. How does this bill get at the issue of the oil's volatility?
Well, that's the great question here, because if we go back just a step, the Department of Transportation, PHMSA, Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, came out with proposed rules last year that would address the trains carrying this oil, but they did not address the volatility. And, you know, this is a multifaceted problem. You know, we're talking about tank cars that need to be replaced. We're talking about rail infrastructure that needs to be looked at, as well as the oil volatility. And the proposed rules from the DOT, which have been delayed, by the way, do not address that. So we thank Senator Baldwin for putting this into the legislation, because it is a piece that has been sorely missed. And basically, what it boils down to, and I hate to use that term, is really there's a lot of dissolved gas in this oil from the Bakken region. It's they call it the champagne of oils. And this oil is extremely volatile. It contains a lot of gases that will ignite even at low temperatures. And since there are no refineries in North Dakota, this oil is basically taken out of the ground without any refinement and dumped into these tank cars. So these tank cars are going down the tracks, and as long as they don't fall off the tracks, there's no incidents really to report. But as soon as something happens, that volatility comes into play and causes the large mushroom clouds of flame that you see on TV. If they took those gases out ahead of time, you wouldn't see that kind of explosion. And so that's the bottom line. North Dakota has come out with their own conditioning, they call it, of the oil that will make a minor adjustment to the volatility, but has no real teeth. And we need the teeth. We need to get that volatility out of the oil. And this legislation would at least put guidelines in place for PHMSA to come out with some meaningful regulations that would reduce the volatility of that oil.
And we got to talk about the train cars themselves. Some of these cars are older models. What does this bill call for as far as changing the structure of the cars?
Well, the cars we're talking about, they're called DOT 111s, and they've been on the rails for many, many years, and the NTSB has been screaming since the 1980s that they need better protection. So some of these cars that are carrying oil are these older type of DOT 111s, but the Association of American Railroads, the AAR, in October of 2011 came out with new rules that made the cars a bit beefier, and these are called CPC 1232s. And those models, of course, have been involved in gosh, we've had 5 major derailments, accidents, fires since the beginning of this year, and at least in 3, if not more, of those incidents involved CPC 1232s. This was a voluntary new standard tank car, but it still falls short. So part of this legislation would be to go for a much beefier tank car with 9/16-inch shells and thermal protection and protection for valves and so forth. One of the main key ingredients, I feel, for these DOT 111s that would become now DOT 117s is thermal protection. Because if you get thermal protection around those tank cars, if there is a fire, it would prevent the contents from boiling right away. It would give the firefighters, first responders, some time to get in there if they have foam available to put out the oil fire before the tank cars start to get so hot that they begin to explode, and that's what causes those large fireballs.
We're talking right now about new proposed oil train safety legislation with Alan Stankovitz from Citizens Acting for Rail Safety. And Alan, you mentioned first responders. Now, they factor into this legislation as well. What would the bill provide for when it comes to equipping responders and communities to deal with disasters should they happen?
Well, this would authorize funding for the first responders for training, equipment, and preparedness. And this is something that's sorely needed. Most of the first responders are not adequately prepared for this. And if you look at what's happened so far this year, in most cases, their first rule of thumb is to get the area evacuated. And then they just pretty much leave it burn because they don't have the equipment or the resources to really do anything more meaningful than that. And, you know, there's a few places that might have foam trailers, which is what you need. You need the special foam to put out an oil fire. So this legislation would give the first responders the training and equipment to make a meaningful impact on these accidents if and when they occur.
And what about accountability measures? Are those built into this legislation?
Yes, that is another big deal, too, because there needs to be accountability not only from the standpoint of the railroads themselves, but also the petroleum industry, because they lease or own the tank cars. So this would definitely put the onus on both of them to do things more safely. And, you know, the railroads are, you know, making a lot of money off of the transport of this oil, but they are also mandated to ship this oil. But the thing that we're finding is that the rail infrastructure across the United States really needs to be beefed up as well. There's a lot of old bridges. A lot of these accidents occur due to track failures, and these are things that we need more inspections. And the FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, just doesn't have, I think they have like something like 78 and 76 inspectors for like the whole United States, and only 6 are bridge inspectors, most of whom are not certified. So this bill would also not only, cause more meaningful legislation for mandating, these rail lines to actually pay for any type of infringements or infractions on this, but it would also fund the FRA to actually do better inspecting, which is another big part of it.
So if an accident does happen with one of these oil trains, there's going to be a bill for the cleanup and all of the things involved in that. How does this bill account for liability issues?
Well, that's another key piece of this. You know, if we go back to what happened in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, Canada, where 47 people lost their lives, the rail company that was actually transporting that train went bankrupt and basically left Canada to foot the bill. And so one of the things that has not really been looked into, there's a lot of things that from a railroad standpoint, are kept secret from us. We don't know how much liability insurance they have. Well, we need to know this, and we need to make sure that those rail companies that are carrying this kind of volatile product have enough liability insurance to cover a major disaster. And this legislation also mandates, or will actually look into how much insurance they have and then come up with guidelines to make sure that they are covered.
Now, and as we wrap up here, Senator Baldwin is one of 4 Democratic senators behind this bill. Now, Republicans at this point have the majority in both houses of Congress. With that in mind, Is this bill a non-starter, or do you think this has the potential to gather bipartisan support?
I think it has potential to gather bipartisan support because we're talking about the safety of our citizens. That, you know, it needs to be, and why wouldn't it be bipartisan if we're talking about making sure that our citizens are kept safe? This is all about safety, and it shouldn't be bipartisan. You know, granted, I'm sure there's going to be lobbyists from the oil and railroad industries that are going to be not too pleased about this, but we really need to put the welfare of our citizens first, and it should not be a bipartisan issue.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking about new proposed legislation on oil train safety with Alan Stankovitz. He's with the group Citizens Acting for Rail Safety. First, we're talking about a quirky shop in Eau Claire focused on building a community around gaming. It's a social gaming and soda lounge called The District Company. Dustin Jepperson is one of the owners, and he's here to talk about The District Company. Dustin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you.
Well, what do we mean when we say the term social gaming? What is that?
So social gaming to us, we describe as the concept of playing games of all sorts against real people, face-to-face rather than hiding behind your computer screen against a stranger or someone you don't know. We really want to foster a sense of fellowship and through competitive gameplay, through face-to-face interpersonal interaction.
Playing games is a big deal right now. There's been a resurgence in all kinds of gaming. Are you seeing that in Eau Claire, where you live?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We we continue to actually evolve the business model that we have around this massive expansion of games of all sorts. Anything from computer games, where we have set up consoles for people to play tournaments and console games like the Wii U, Xboxes, PlayStations, that kind of thing, to computer gaming, to card gaming, collectible cards, or otherwise, board games, other tabletop games, and a wide variety of people. And each of those communities continues to grow. Certainly something that we've seen as people flock to our stores to play those things and interact with others who are like-minded.
Well, one of the things you'd like to do is to get newcomers involved into that gaming community. So how do you create, you know, a sense of community around games that have a lot of old-timers who might have been playing that game for a long time and maybe be a little particular about the way the game is played?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually our mission and our vision for our store is to continue to evolve and develop the gaming community. And we do that through a variety of ways. As I mentioned, we have lots of different games that people come into the store to play. We reach out to those communities both through the old-timers, the veterans within each of those games to encourage them to bring newcomers in, but we also offer weekly and daily tournaments. We host tutoring sessions for newcomers. We create new experiences. For instance, we just kicked off a new thing we call the tabletop board game experience, where we bring in a board game, teach and demo it, throw it up on a projector screen, and teach people how to play the game, and actually immerse people within the theme of the game. So a couple weeks ago, we played a game called Takedo, which is a Japanese kind of food tourism-based game. So we brought in some sushi, catered in sushi, and brought the community around that to overall experience it, meet new people, and just have a good time.
Well, what kind of games are hot right now? Are people wanting to play at your store?
Like I mentioned, we have a lot of people coming in to play card games, collectible card games in particular, such as Pokemon, Magic the Gathering, Yu-Gi-Oh! There's also board games of all types, PC and console games, and then even some of the more, you might say, hardcore gamers coming in playing Warhammer and miniature games, role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinders, Star Wars, League of Legends on the PCs, and even tournaments for Super Smash Brothers on the Wii U. Those are some of the things that we see most often currently.
One of the issues that you hear people talking about when it comes to online gaming and also offline gaming is getting women involved, getting people, you know, besides men playing these games regularly. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing a diverse group of people coming together to play?
We actually are, and one of the amazing things about that is I think we're doing so in two key ways. One, we're really encouraging casual play. We want people to come in and not feel like it's an overly competitive environment, that they're welcome to come in and sit down at a table with someone who's playing a game and teach them how to play. We'll even actively get involved with bringing groups together, teaching them games, and helping them learn and get involved. So that has helped across both male and female coming into the store. Also, the soda lounge aspect of our store has helped a lot with that. Rather than just being a game store and trying to facilitate the playing of these games, we also are a soda lounge where we host over 100 different types of glass bottle sodas, very unique. Each one in itself is a conversation starter, just like the social gaming aspect, and so it goes hand in hand with the gaming, and that attracts a lot of people from all walks of life, old, young, male, female, across the board, to engage in conversation, try something unique, meet someone new, and then build that camaraderie around a game within the store.
We're talking about the social gaming and soda lounge called the District Company in Eau Claire with one of the owners, Dustin Jepperson. And let's get into that soda part of it. So if you're not coming for the games, you can have a soda and hang out. And not just any soda. You have lots of unique sodas. What is it? What's special to you about having all these crazy, unique sodas from around the world?
Yeah, great question. So kind of as I said, it brings people in as a conversation starter. You can come in and try something that you've never tried and probably never even heard of. Everything from a classic like Moxie, which has been around since 1876, one of the oldest sodas, and originated as a medicine, as a Moxie nerve food, to something like chocolate-covered maple-smoked bacon soda.
Right, I have to stop you right there. Chocolate-covered maple-smoked bacon soda, really?
That's right, yep, and amazingly, it tastes exactly like it sounds.
Is that a good thing?
It is. It's breakfast in a bottle. And it gets people talking around topics of the soda, just the uniqueness of it, the glass bottle component of it. We have the labels that interact with people, such as Leninade, which is a Soviet-themed soda covered with Soviet Union puns, that sort of just engages the customer to come in and pick it up and laugh and start a conversation, to Spruce Beer, which is a flavored soda flavored with a pine tree, pine needles, and evergreen needles, and it has a unique history here in North America. In fact, during the harsh winter months to ward off scurvy, they used evergreen needles in beverages when fresh fruit and nuts were not available. So each soda, each hundred of these 150 sodas has its own backstory, its own conversation starter, and as an added bonus, they taste great.
Do you have a favorite?
One of my favorites, other than of course chocolate covered maple smoked bacon, is Ale 8-1. This is a soda that's been around and manufactured in Winchester, Kentucky, since 1926. And it's interesting. It's sort of like they describe it as ginger ale with a kick, but it's a ginger and citrus flavored soda. The name originated, interestingly, by its inventor G.L. Wainscott. Out in Winchester, he submitted it as one of America's first slogan contests at the Clark County Fair as a late one, and that pun was the winning entry, and hence the name Ale 8-1, and has since been passed down through the family for generations. Still family business, growing in popularity, and even generates spin-off products such as Suckers and even its own salsa. So it's sort of a fun community that centers around these typically family-owned businesses that start these very unique craft sodas.
So you get your customers all hopped up on the sugary soda, and you set them loose to play games. There must be stories that come out of this. Have you seen kind of unique connections happening with people there that have stuck with you?
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting. We get a lot of regulars that come in the store that the store is actually almost like a second home to them. And we really focus and encourage, along with social gaming, all of the benefits of play. Playing games and interacting with others really helps to support critical thinking skills and engages brain stimulation, the laughter and enjoyment through collaboration, social engagement to reduce isolation, good sportsmanship and through communication, reduce stress. And what we get is a lot of people that come in who are a little more reserved, who might be inclined to fall in that realm of isolation, come in and they find a family there, other like-minded people that they can interact with. Us within the stores, we're encouraging them to meet others and just experience the atmosphere that we have there in the store. And we definitely see and we hear things from just interesting life stories from these people who you may not have otherwise met that you get to meet through these social gaming aspects.
Dustin, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Dustin Jepperson, one of the owners of the District Company in Eau Claire. First, we're talking to a guest who says we live in an era of irrational parenting. Despite a downward trend in crime statistics, many parents today are afraid to let kids go beyond their front yard without a grown-up along. Jennifer Senior is the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She wrote about irrational parenting for New York Magazine. Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
So why do you think that modern parents are irrational?
Well, I will say my editors put that headline on there. I'm not sure I would have gone quite so far and made such a sweeping statement about all parents. I think the point is this. When it comes to safety, there are certainly cultural trends involving parenting that do not seem to be, that don't seem to correspond with what the data suggests, right? The data suggests that it's never been a safer time to let your kid play outside. It's never been a safer time to put your kid in an automobile. It's never been a safer time to let your kid walk home from a public place. And yet, we are hovering over them. We are barely letting them walk or ride a bike to school. We are incredibly protective of them in ways that suggest that the crime data would look the exact opposite. So the question is why? And the answer, I think, has to do with a variety of things, but I'll just give one for now. We defer having kids. If you're a college-educated woman, you're not going to have your first kid until you're 30. And your husband, if he's college-educated, is going to be 32 years old. And I think what this does is it makes us look at children as this enormous kind of life event and investment. We just assign a lot of significance to this experience once we finally have kids. And it makes people, extremely kind of protective of their investments in ways that they might not necessarily have been if they'd had like five kids starting from the time that they were 22.
But maybe that's a good thing, right? Maybe this hypervigilance that parents have about kids is the reason that these statistics of harm coming to kids are so low.
I would have said that. But there are two things that absolutely flat out contradict that. I mean, I looked into that thinking, well, maybe all this helicoptering is paying off. First of all, not only are stranger abduction rates falling, abduction rates within families are falling. Families are more likely to abduct kids than strangers are. And those are falling at an even faster rate, right? So why would that be the case? The other thing is that crime rates generally are falling. And adults are certainly taking advantage of this. I mean, now as an adult in New York City, a woman, I walk around at 3 a.m. by myself in neighborhoods that my parents would never in 100 years have imagined would be safe, right? We are all doing this. We are all taking advantage of plunging crime rates nationally. But we're not letting our kids take advantage of it. I mean, and if they're falling across the board for, if they're falling for adults, there's no reason to assume that the trend lines would be any different for kids. And nothing seems to suggest it is.
Well, if you look at some of the media coverage recently, it was maybe about a month ago, there was some parents on the East Coast who let their children take a walk by themselves, and they're getting an unsubstantiated child neglect charge. So maybe the pressure is coming from places other than the parents themselves.
Now I think when you say other than the parents themselves, actually, I mean, what's fascinating about that particular case, which was in Silver Spring, Maryland, two kids of scientists, right, who embraced kind of the philosophy that a kid ought to be able to roam free, were walking home from a park, and they were not in any kind of imminent danger. They were picked up by the cops not because they were in danger, but because another parent had called the cops. So I think that actually, in a funny way, there's just this culture surrounding parenthood that's extremely burdensome, I think, for many of us. Jerome Kagan, the developmental psychologist who did like some of his best work in the 70s, in the, I guess, late 80s or early 90s, he wrote an essay that was very prescient. He said that in public life, there is almost no way to establish yourself as a moral person anymore. You know, it used to be that we took care of our aging parents so our neighbors could see how wonderful we were because we did this, or we were involved in neighborhood organizations and civic groups so everyone could see, you know, that we were willing to make a difference. And civic participation has gone way down. We now, you know, put our parents in old folks' homes and things like that. The only way to show our moral worth today is through our parenting. That's how we strut our plumage. And I think that that has created this culture of surveillance and judgment and censure rather than one of collaboration and, you know, helpfulness. And I think it's not doing any of us one lick of good.
Why do you say it's not doing us any good? I mean, I guess I'm not arguing that it is doing us good, but is it actually doing us harm?
Well, first of all, you have two kids who were picked up by the police, which is in and of itself like quite traumatizing, right? I don't think that helped them. Those kids were perfectly safe walking home. Their parents had made a perfectly rational calculation that in their extremely safe neighborhood, in broad daylight, after school, it was okay to walk home, you know? And instead, they were greeted by a police car. And the police themselves, and Child Protective Services themselves could find absolutely nothing wrong. No imminent signs of danger. They came up with nothing. So to me, that's not doing anyone any good. It's suddenly scarring the kids. It's throwing into question for them whether or not their own parents have their best interests at heart. And it's kind of creating this incredibly weird, scary memory of a police car coming by and picking them up. I'm not sure I see how that works out. I mean, I think we'd be much better off if we were just simply mindful of kids on the street and made sure that they got to where they were supposed to be safely and all agreed that we were going to have our kids walking around in groups. I mean, I think that helps everyone. It helps them foster, like, a sense of independence, right? Then they actually feel like they're capable of doing something because, you know, you don't want to inhibit them and think that they are capable of doing less than they are capable of doing. And it also, you know, sort of creates an esprit de corps among parents where they feel like they all have everybody's kids, you know, in their sight lines and that they're all going to be helping out and pitching in.
Well, taking a look at that sight lines issue, that's something that's maybe changed over the past decade or so as you have more two parent families who have both parents working. And so in other words, there's not someone who's watching the street at all times. Is that something that you see?
Yes, definitely. And I think that a lot of this is about anxiety about women actually being at work and the fact that there aren't as many eyes on the street. I think that that's certainly true. Nevertheless, you know, when women were home, you know, back in the 70s, kids were told to get on their bikes and to, you know, not come home until supper time when they banged a gong. You know, and back in 1969, 40% of all American kids were walking to school or biking to school, and now it's about 13%, so it's much lower. So I do think that there's certainly anxiety about it, but, you know, just because parents are there doesn't mean that they're paying attention, by the way. It might just be a signifier of our anxiety, not like actually a material, you know, not materially consequential in any way.
It's hard not to be critical of parents, no matter what the age is, because if you look at our parents' generation, in that time, you might say, oh, those parents neglected their kids. They didn't spend enough time with their children. They didn't play with their children. You know,
talking
to parents who said, my dad never played with me. Why does my kid want, me to play with him or her? So, I mean, isn't there always some critique we're going to make? And maybe we just overcorrected for the errors of the past.
There's definitely the thought that, like, maybe the needle is now just swinging the other way. And that, you know, we were all raised by a generation that looked maybe not quite like Betty Draper and Don Draper and Mad Men, you know, where they're, like, tossing back vodka tonics and telling their kids to watch TV, but maybe something like that, and so we're going to be much more engaged. I mean, maybe, you know, it's possible that it's compensatory, and certainly it's every human's instinct to gossip. But, you know, I think that there are, I don't find this a particularly constructive form of criticism or gossip. I think that, you know, telling your 10-year-old to walk home in broad daylight in one of the safest neighborhoods imaginable, you know, it just doesn't strike me as a particularly dangerous thing. And I think having a bunch of, you know, local gossips call the cops on you is just not particularly constructive or helpful.
We're talking right now to New York Magazine writer Jen Senior. She says we live in an age of irrational parenting. Well, at least we overblow the dangers to our children when it's actually a really safe time to be a kid. So, Jen, is this something that other countries, other cultures you see struggling with, or is this uniquely American somehow?
You know, I'm not looked at data around. There's a really beguiling chart in the UK that shows the same kind of shrinking circumference around a kid, you know, that it used to be the kids could walk 6 miles if they were 8 years old, then they could walk one, and then they could walk a block, you know, I mean, it's the same thing. But I don't know what that data looks like internationally, and I'd be very interested to see it. And, of course, there are different norms in different cultures and different bikes, you know, bike usages, and, you know, it's going to depend on cities versus countries. So, you know, it's an interesting question. It's one I should look into more.
You were talking some about the morality issue earlier, that when we parent, and we parent maybe in an overly protective way, that it's somehow establishing our moral authority or our moral worth. Who is it, do you think, that we're trying to display that for?
Other parents. I mean, you know, think about what your Facebook feed looks like and all the weird kind of competitive tensions that are subtly kind of woven in. I mean, not in mine. I don't tend to follow or have friends like that. But, I mean, I think that people are, you know, and that's what Pinterest is kind of predicated on. I mean, there's a lot of ways that I think a lot of parents want to establish, you know, how great they are at this. And, you know, I think anxiety about being a present parent, if you're working, is certainly one very poignant reason people might do it. You know, but again, like, I go back to the idea that we used to have other ways of showing this. When we were more involved in public institutions and at civic organizations and neighborhood organizations, and when we took care of our own aging parents, you know, people saw what we were doing and the kinds of, you know, family men and women that we were. And it's harder to see that now. We're all super busy and working a lot.
Well, we're talking right now with New York Magazine writer Jennifer Senior about why she says parents are overprotective when right now it's a safe time to be a kid. And we want you to weigh in on this. Do you see parents obsessively worrying about the safety of their children? Do you think parents today are irrational when it comes to the risks of childhood? And if you're a parent or a grandparent, what do you think? How do you behave with your kids? Are you super concerned about safety, or do you like to go a little more free range with your style? Call it 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with Jennifer Senior about how she says parents are disproportionately obsessed with the safety of their children today. And we're taking your calls. What do you think has contributed to an age of maybe irrational parenting? If you're a parent or a grandparent, how do you make sure your kids are safe without going overboard? Do you agree that parents are too obsessed with safety, or do you think it's a good idea to be vigilant? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go to our callers now. We've got Peter on the line in Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon. I blame this helicopter parent routine or syndrome pretty much on the advent of the Internet. 20 years ago, if something happened, you might read about it in the paper, and maybe your mother-in-law would send you an article about something like that. But now, well, you were referring to that couple who was investigated for letting their kids walk home from school, and I can't even remember where that was, but we wouldn't have known about that 20 years ago. So I think a lot of it is the information that gets distributed on the Internet that normally wouldn't have been seen not very long ago.
Hey, Peter, thanks a lot. And Jen, is there something to that? Does the sensational stuff tend to get passed around more?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And this is something that I wrote about pretty extensively in my book, that I was really surprised by how many people were spooked by, number one, the 24/7 news cycle, which includes, of course, lots of stuff that you see on Facebook and the Internet as well, where, you know, one kidnapping story in one place, which gets, you know, kind of sensationally replayed over and over again, right, on cable news, becomes, it looks suddenly as if that's kind of normal and not an exceptional experience. That's one thing. The other thing about the Internet, I was surprised when a part of my book takes place in Texas, and I remember talking to all these mothers in Texas who are in these beautiful, ravishing, lushly landscaped neighborhoods. It couldn't have been nicer, upper middle class, and they wouldn't let their kids be on their front lawns. And Texas has a transparent, it's got an Internet sex offender registry. So you can see where all the sex offenders live in your neighborhood, and you'll find them. You know, that's what happens when you've got internet transparency. They've always lived near you, but now we can know their addresses. And, you know, sex offender is a very kind of broad term, but doesn't matter, right? Like, you just immediately know exactly where their address is. You know it's a mile from your home, and you panic. So I agree completely. What's strange is that more information in this case, or exposure to more information in this case, doesn't necessarily make us behave more rationally.
Well, thank you for that call. We're going to go next to Felicia in Sun Prairie. Felicia, hi.
Hi. My question was, I have kids in the Sun Prairie school system, but when we were in Canada, we received paperwork that said that 30% of girls, or females rather, in the United States, up to, I believe, by the age of 21, 30% have been sexually assaulted, and 20% of boys. So my question is, how do you tell your kid, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't there to supervise you, this is why this happened to you, when you know that 30% of females, this is going to happen to?
Great point. Thanks, Felicia. And, you know, we hear all the time that knowledge is power. You have knowledge like that about the statistics. As a parent, you feel like you have an obligation to protect your kid and be there, don't you?
Yeah, of course, of course. Number one, there's a lot of kind of, I mean, there are conflicting bodies of statistics and data about exactly what about sexual assault rates. I don't want to get into whether or not those numbers are right or wrong, and I don't want to minimize or trivialize how very real that problem is. I will say this. Being sexually assaulted in broad daylight while coming home from school is much less of a problem than being sexually assaulted at a party that you yourself drove your kid to, or while your kid is home alone while you're not there with another kid. You know, those dangers tend to be from kids that other kids know, right? That's where things get very, I mean, bullying at the hands of other kids, assault at the hands of other kids, those are much realer dangers. But they are not about sending your kid outside. You know, to me, those are separate questions. So she's raising a very profound and important point, and it's a much more devilish problem to contend with. But in my mind, it's because it's driven by, like, kids you know and trust, or parents of the kids that you know. I mean, this gets hairy very quickly, because we're not talking about, like, letting a kid walk home from a park most of the time.
Felicia, thank you for that call. We're talking right now to New York Magazine writer Jen Senior about how parents today tend to overestimate the amount of risk to their children. And we go next to a caller in Milwaukee. Linda's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I was just listening, and I just listened in, but I'm wondering, your guest mentioned sex offenders, but I just saw a program about human trafficking, and they gave this huge number of how many persons go missing every year. And they talked about how it's not a safe world anymore to allow your children to just be out and about, because across all lines, children are being taken.
Thank you so much for calling with that, Linda. And yeah, we've got the sex offenders, we've got human traffickers, and we know all this because we watch TV and we read stuff on the internet. So as a parent, if you're the one who gets caught with your guard down, you're going to feel terrible. Is it better safe than sorry in this case?
I mean, I think that the human trafficking story was in the news because there's a bill right now, you know, in Congress about this very issue. You know, again, I would go back to the fact that the number of children who are abducted every year is still very, I mean, let's put it this way. It's much more unsafe to get into a car with your kids. Right, much more. And the odds of getting into a car accident with your kids are much greater than your kid being, suddenly snatched away from you and shunted into some kind of sex trafficking ring. I mean, you know, these are not even comparable. You know, the odds are, it's probably much riskier for your kid to be on a bike. You know, it's much riskier. And unfortunately, and I'm not saying that these harms don't exist and that there isn't a small chance. I mean, in the way that there's a chance that I could slip and hurt myself in my bathtub, everything is associated with a certain level of risk. But this is, in a funny way, a little bit like what I was describing before, where I said we see a report on television and decide that it's emblematic of a larger trend, when in fact, actually, I'm sure that that piece was on TV because there's a sex trafficking bill right now in Congress that wants to penalize people who've actually, you know, wants to impose stricter fines on people who've been complicit and helped, and, you know, and it's now getting snagged in all kinds of, you know, Republicans and Democrats have different ideas about about what they want to append to it. It's actually not really about the inherent harms of sex. I'm guessing that the impetus for that story wasn't about, oh, gee, oh, my God, the world is filled with sex traffickers.
And Jen, just in our last little bit of time here, just a few seconds, what should parents do if they want to loosen up this culture a little bit and give their kids more leash to roam on?
You know, I wonder if, like, you know, parents in particular neighborhoods ought to just start talking to one another and saying, why don't we all agree that today they're going to walk to each other's houses? You know, that they're going to, like, kind of go in gangs of three and four. You know, I mean, that's one possibility. You can have them walking with each other and checking in. You know, you can decide that, you know, your 11-year-olds are all going to walk somewhere as a group. I mean, there are small things you can just do, making the decision within your own neighborhood or with friends, with other friends, you know.
And we leave it there. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were speaking with Jennifer Senior, the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She wrote about irrational parenting for New York Magazine.